Maths. Love it or hate it, you can't escape it. And I'm sure that most of us were in one camp or the other at school, depending on whether you got it or not. Eddie Wu didn't get it when he was at school. As he says, to teenage me, mathematics was about memorising arcane rules I didn't comprehend to solve contrived problems I didn't care about. Now that I understand. I think I'm giving away what camp I might have been on in. Well, he certainly switched camps though, because today Eddie is arguably the most famous maths teacher in Australia at Cherrybrook Technology High School in Sydney. 5 years ago, he started an online maths tutorial for one of his students who couldn't attend school. And today, his YouTube maths channel, WooTube, has racked up over 600,000 subscribers and more than 34 million views. Eddie Wu is now famous for his love of maths and how it can change lives, as it did for him. Recognised as a local hero on Australia Day last year, Eddie has just published a second book, Eddie Wu's Magical Maths, following last year's offering, Wu's Wonderful World of Maths. Eddie Wu, welcome to the year that made me.
Thanks for having me, Liz.
I have to say, maths was never a great love of mine. I was never very good at it. And so I'm intrigued to hear that, you know, you too were in that category once upon a time, although you managed to turn that around. And we'll come to that later. But I want to go right back to the beginning, because you had a really difficult time at school. You didn't like school for a long time. And it wasn't because of your hatred of maths at the time.
No.
So tell us about that.
Yeah, sure. It's quite bizarre for me to think back on my upbringing, my early years, particularly now from the lens of being a teacher at the moment, and thinking about what kid I was at school and how I as an educator now would look at a kid like that. So the label that would have been given to me, certainly by my teachers in my school, I was what you would call a school refuser. So this is the kind of kid who has a terrible pattern of attendance. There's nothing to do with illness or any other kind of, you know, family turmoil that results in that, just for whatever reason. There's an emotional, and it can be a physical, barrier to being present at school and being in that environment. And a large reason for that was that when I was growing up, particularly in early primary, I was quite severely bullied at school. And it was sort of a function of the fact that I didn't look like many of the people who I went to school with. You know, born and raised in suburban Sydney, northwest Sydney. And it was, you know, back in the days when, even in a political climate, there was kind of this cynicism and this anxiety around Asians and what they kind of represented. My response was just, I don't want to go. I don't want to be spoken to like that or treated like that, or I don't want to be beaten up on my way home. That was kind of what the early years of primary were characterized for me.
And did that happen to you? Were you physically assaulted because you were Asian?
Yeah, no, I mean, that's not me imagining. Like those are things that happened. And, you know, I'd wake up and, you know, the sun would be up and my brother and sister would head off to school or uni, and I would just curl up in a fetal position because I didn't want to go. I knew what was waiting for me and was just not keen to experience that again. So that was my experience.
So how did your parents handle that?
My very long-suffering mum, she was so wise, and she knew not to sort of confront that head on and just say, you know, it's time to go. I'm going to drag you out by your ears. She was always so kind and warm and gentle with me. And I think she knew that to try and force me would be a mistake, and it would end up making me hate school even more. So often sometimes what she would do is she'd leave me there. She'd ask me, of course, like, it's time to go. But when I really, you know, dug my heels in, she would then spend the day with me, and we would kind of recuperate and talk through what had happened the previous day and what was the particularly traumatic thing that had made me not want to go to school that day. And I think it was just that time and that consistent positivity that made me realize, okay, this is not something that I necessarily enjoy, but it's important. And it's something which, you know, my mum herself, having immigrated here in the 70s, knew was part of what it meant to have a migrant identity, but was absolutely worth pushing through for the sake of the goal, which was the kind of world-class education that anyone can get in
right.
Australia.
So she sort of tried to encourage you to cope with it, really, because ultimately it would be worth it.
Yeah, it was very much, she had that idea of you play the long game. You know, why we had come to Australia was that, you know, people of a Chinese ethnic background, as both of my parents are, in a place like Malaysia, which in terms of the racial profile of the country, certainly people from a Chinese background couldn't, for example, get a job with the government, couldn't ever own more than 49% of a business, couldn't get practically past certain levels of education. That's why they came to this land of opportunity. And so it was kind of like, this is why we're here. It's absolutely worth it. But you're going to have to stick through some tough times if you're going to get those benefits out of it.
And Eddie, what was her advice to you in terms of coping? What did she say you should do when they come and bash you up on your way home from school?
Yeah, look, well, I mean, you can see right now sitting across from me, Liz.
You're not a big guy, Eddie.
No. fighting back was not really going to be an option. And she said her advice to me was, look, and I think about this now as an educator, right? Often what a bully is after is a sense of power themselves. Many bullies classically are people who are disempowered themselves. Perhaps there's an abusive relationship in their own home or something like that. And so that wanting to experience power themselves resides largely actually in the person whom they bully and in the response that they give. And my mom said to me, look, don't gratify them with the fear and the response that they want. They can do whatever they want verbally or physically, but you're in control of how you respond to that emotionally. And that was her advice to me, to ride that out and know that there was going to be a light at the end of the tunnel.
She was very wise. Okay, let's talk about your schoolwork. You were smart, right? You were smart.
I always enjoyed learning, but I resist the label smart for a couple of reasons, I guess. The first one is, and you sort of mentioned it in your introduction, I think that sometimes we can become sort of wanting to put people into categories, and so quickly sometimes we'll label a kid, you know, gifted or weak or whatever in a particular area, and that can be so defining to someone's identity when they're told, this is who you are, this is what you're capable of, this is what you're not capable of.
That's true.
So that's kind of why I bristle a little bit. I would never, for example, call any of my students smart or not smart, because it's kind of, that's part of what we're here to work out, you know, and to grow and to develop. But I did always from a young age. I was a voracious learner. I loved to read. I put part of that down to the fact that I'm the third of three children. My brother and sister are relatively close in age compared to me. So they could always go and watch the same movies. They could go and do the same kinds of activities. And then there was little old me. I was too small, too uncoordinated, the wrong age for the rating of the movie to do the same things they did. So I had to make myself content with kind of things I could do on my own. So that's sort of what turned me into books and reading. And I just loved being in a space where I could discover new things.
But you didn't like maths.
No, maths was not something I gravitated towards in any way. I think part of the issue, and it comes back to that sort of definition of smart, is that even though I could do maths, I always found myself quite slow in mathematics. And certainly from a schooling point of view, if you aren't very quick at doing maths, then, you know, other kids will put their hand up first. Other kids will get better marks in exams. And so in terms of the labeling that I got, I had no talent or affinity for the subject. I much more gravitated towards things I could read, storytelling and characters. So I was a real humanities geek at school.
For how long?
Oh, look, all the way through. So up until my HSC, you know, for my year 12 subjects, I took 4 units of English. So 2 are compulsory. 3 are what you do if you really love reading. And 4 is what you do if you're slightly mad. So I did 4 units of English. I did 3 units of history, modern history plus extension. I did 2 units of drama. So that was my graduating certificate. That's what my pattern of study looked like. So all the way to the end of schooling, I fit very happily in that humanities niche.
But you still did maths.
I did. Yeah, absolutely.
Level of maths did you end up doing?
So the level of maths I did was called Mathematics Extension 1. I had no particular, like, I didn't enjoy it, but I could do it. My memory was good enough that I could look at a formula, I could commit it to memory, and I was good enough generally at guessing from the cues in a question, which formula am I supposed to use here? So I didn't have what we'd call any deep conceptual understanding. The thing I now realize as a teacher, the thing that really matters. So I did do the maths, but didn't really get it, if that makes sense.
So you took yourself off to Sydney Uni. This is really a very strange thing to have happened. I can't imagine this happening, but I know it did. So I want you to tell this story. You're standing in this corridor. You think you're going to enroll in a humanities subject, but that's not what happens. Tell us how that unfolded.
So as I mentioned, coming out of high school, because English and history were clearly my strong subjects, I went to my teachers and I said to them, look, I want to be a teacher. And after my teachers themselves had stopped trying to convince me not to become a teacher, they realized I'm committed to this, I'm serious about it. I said, well, what should I teach? I briefly contemplated primary. But then when I settled on secondary, they said, look, you got to choose a subject. You choose the subjects you're good at. So English and history was what was written on my enrollment form. And I was standing there in the line because this is back in the days before online enrollment. And it was, I think it was one of the associate deans or professors of the Faculty of Education. It was just wondering.
You're not even
us.
Sure who it was.
No, I mean, I have guesses in my mind now, but in fact, it wasn't really, like, I'd never met this person.
We got to find out who that was.
Yeah, look, I've got some theories. So anyhow, I because I'm not 100% sure, that's why I'm not going out and saying it was him, you know, just in case he's like, no, I take no responsibility. I've unleashed this monster on the world. This professor, he came up to me and he said hi, he greeted me. And then he looked at my enrollment form and he said, look, I'm not going to force you to change your mind, but at least at the moment in New South Wales, we actually have plenty of English and history teachers, lots and lots of really good ones. You know what we don't have? We don't have very many maths teachers. That's where the real dire need is. And I hadn't experienced any of this when I was at school, but what I then discovered standing there in the Faculty of Education office was we currently have about, 3/4 of the number of maths teachers that we're supposed to have in New South Wales. And this is actually very consistent across the country. So that's why a lot of people, their experience of learning maths at school was less than inspiring.
Because they weren't being taught by maths teachers.
No, exactly. I mean, if you put me in a Spanish classroom.
Maybe that was my problem.
sadly, if we run the numbers, you know, roughly 15% of people by the end of year 10, only 15% of people have had a maths teacher every single year going through. The rest of us, the other 85%, at least at some point, we had someone else. And we're really grateful for them, by the way. Like, they do a really great job in tough circumstances, but they don't have the same kind of conceptual framework that a trained someone with a maths degree has. So I wouldn't expect them to do as good a job as someone else. And that one year, sometimes that's it. Mm. You know, so many people I meet, they're like, I got maths until they started putting letters in there. And then just everything went haywire. And with maths, all the knowledge is so interconnected. If you miss one big piece, you just can't ever get back on the horse.
You can't catch up.
Yeah, there's no catch up. So I realized that if this was a situation in Australia, that we don't have enough maths teachers. And he said, look, you've done a fair bit of maths, as you pointed out. I'd done it at school, even though I didn't enjoy it. He said, you've got enough of a foundation to build on. Would you consider changing your degree? And for me, being a teacher was all about working with kids. It wasn't about a particular subject. So that's what sent me down this rabbit hole.
But that's an extraordinary decision to make, I think. You were 18.
Yes.
To change your position on that and to decide to teach a subject that you didn't particularly enjoy.
Mm. Well, I mean, I guess in some ways, you're right. On paper like that, it does sound a bit crazy. I wonder sometimes if people look at me and they're like, did you just tick the wrong box? You ended up in the wrong place. But I guess just coming back, the thing that motivated me to become a high school teacher in the first place is just that when you see a kid come in at age 12, you could fit them inside their bag. That's how little they are. And they're so needy and dependent. In my year 7 class, I've got kids, they put up their hand for everything. They're like, sir, do we have to write a heading for this? Sir, do I draw this diagram? They need guidance on everything. That's what they like when they enter. They leave, they're 18 years old. They're voting. They're ready to make decisions about the trajectory of their life and contribute back to society as adults. That transformation I find amazing. To watch it every time, it's a huge privilege to be a part of. So for me, what drew me toward teaching was not that I love a subject and I want to, you know, show people it's great. It was that involvement, that very personal journey that I get to contribute to. And so it's sort of in that light, you know, I mean, this sounds a bit weird, but if tomorrow they outlawed mathematics and they said, Eddie, you're not allowed to teach maths anymore. Yeah, I'd cry a little bit. I'd shed a tear, but I'd just go and find something else to teach because it's the kids that really motivate me and they're why I love what I do.
We'd have WooTube English.
Right. It would be a very different set of videos, I think.
I want to take you back just a little bit. You mentioned, well, you've mentioned your love of teaching, but you've also mentioned that teachers told you, no, no, don't do it. What did your family think about it?
I think my family were just perplexed. It just came completely out of left field for them. My brother, he, you know, I looked up to him. I always have looked up to him, actually. He's 8 years older than me. He went into IT, and for a long time, I was just going to follow him into that field. But then when I was middle of high school, the dot-com boom was followed by the dot-com bust. And I thought, probably good to get a degree that'll let me get a job out of this. And so I think they were quite surprised to realize this was something I contemplated. And my mom certainly, she definitely tried to talk me out of it.
She wasn't happy about
it. No. She knows, as is just a fact. It's just objectively true. In Australia, you know, teachers are not highly respected, not paid very well. That's not the reason they left their country, their homeland, to come here. That wasn't the deal.
But look at you now, Eddie.
Well, yeah, I hope.
She would be so very proud of you, I'm sure.
I hope so. That's the hope.
Did she ever get to see any of that?
My mum passed away when I was halfway through my first year of uni. So it's a long time ago now, 15 years. And, you know, I think she got a sense that I was certainly committed to what I wanted to do and I had a passion for it. But, you know, I guess a lot of 18, 19-year-olds have that. And it's different looking back from the vantage point of someone in his 30s saying, look, I've stuck with this after more than a decade of teaching. It's something I'm more and more committed to every day. So I'm sad that she didn't get to see that in person, but I hope it'd be something she's proud of.
She would be so proud of you, Eddie. No doubt. She'd be watching those WooTubes every day. I can guarantee it. So 2004, you mentioned it's the year that your mum died. So it's a very special year for you for a number of reasons. And this is the year that you've chosen as the year that made you. Tell me why and tell me what your song is.
I think that we all know, it's just a fact of life that we change and we grow and we develop as human beings, not on the sunny days. It's on the dark days. That's when we are confronted with who we are and have to rise above what we were before. And, you know, I, as the youngest of three, I'm not going to lie, my mom certainly babied me and I was kind of typical, spoiled, you know. I'm really embarrassed even to say this, but my mom made my lunch every single day that I went to school from kindy to year 12. And it's like, come on, kid, you should learn to do that yourself, right? And so when she passed away, I really had to sort of, oh, okay, I'm going to have to grow up real fast. In very quick succession after my mum passed away, my brother and sister, they both moved out. It was just my dad and I. It was kind of like bachelor pad 2.0 and we kind of had to make do. And that really kind of, it pushed me to grow up fast. And it also has given me a sense of understanding for what children go through. I think about the children I teach. And because of what I've gone through as a child, as a student myself, my mum was diagnosed with cancer when I was in year 10. I know in my classroom of 30 kids, I can guarantee there's 3 or 4 or 5 of them, they're going through the hardest period of their life and no one knows about it. I don't know about it. Their friends don't know about it. My mum was a very private person. And so she didn't want any of my friends to know. Just a few people, a few teachers at my school knew what she was going through. She didn't want me to be the kid whose mom has cancer. So I'd either miss school because I was looking after, or I'd just turn up bags under my eyes because I was changing her oxygen tank throughout the night because it was lung cancer that she had. But no one knew what was going on.
Didn't tell your friends.
No, she absolutely didn't want me to tell them. And so I know, I look at kids, I walk through the playground, I just look out across the faces and I know at a school of 2,000 kids, you've got hundreds of these children going through an enormously difficult time and what they need is just someone to be beside them. and not tell them what to do, but to emotionally support them through that journey and provide them the guidance and the care that they need at that point in their life. So that's enormously shaped, like, the educator who I am today, the parent who I am today. Of course, that was the year when I, you know, went down the journey to become a mathematics teacher. And it's kind of arguably what sort of defines who I am to most people. And, you know, that period of my life, just coming to that song, I spent...
Tell us what the song is.
Yeah, it's Don't Dream It's Over by Crowded House. Mm-hmm. I spent many thousands of hours listening to that on repeat. And I think that, you know, there's something about this song that it's got that pathos, that willingness to express grief in the lyrics, in the organ, in the, it's just, for me, embodied the emotions that I felt, but in a sense of hope as well. And that's why that song means so much to me.
Eddie Wu, it's been a delight to have you on the program today. Thank you so much.
My pleasure. Thanks, Liz.
And here's Crowded House. Don't Dream It's Over by Crowded House, the song chosen by my guest for the year that made me, Eddie Wu.